Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Fair Data Podcast, where we discuss all things FAIR, making data findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. I'm Rory McNeil, host of the FAIR Data Podcast, and my guest today is Donnie Winston, who, among other things, is founder and principal consultant at Polyneme, a software and data consultancy. Donnie, welcome. It's great to have you on the podcast.
It's great that you and Meros do this podcast. Thanks for inviting me.
A pleasure. So actually, I know you have your own podcast, Machine-Centric Science, and I'm actually really looking forward to talking about that in a bit. But first, let's hear about your academic journey, which I think is fair to say is the background to your current focus on data collaboration and sharing.
Sure. In high school, I faced what I thought was a fork in the road. I loved computer programming and the web, but I was also awestruck by nanotechnology, in particular the vision in Eric Drexler's book, Nanosystems. I figured that computer science was something I could do on a laptop in a public library, but nanotech needed expensive equipment and space, and people wouldn't let me into that world unless I had some specific education and training. As best I could tell at the time with my teenage brain, electrical engineering was a fertile field for R&D of practical nanoscale systems through integrated circuits. I was delighted that UC Berkeley had a joint department of EE and CS, and I hoped they would prepare me for the kind of career I wanted. I ended up doing undergrad research with Lydia Son, who was in the mechanical engineering department and had a PhD in physics, which, among other things, made me realize that this nanotech stuff I was excited about didn't really have a neat academic department home. Although I was still in the EECS department at MIT for my PhD and in an electronics group at Hewlett-Packard Labs for a postdoc, I worked a lot with people with formal backgrounds or affiliations in physics, chemistry, material science, various engineering disciplines, and computer science.
Yeah, so that's actually an amazing array of different fields, and I suppose after your postdoc at Hewlett-Packard Labs, you started a new chapter and got into web development at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. What was the transition like? Tell us about that.
Right. It was actually a weird, strange decision. It wasn't my decision to apply for a web developer job at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, but my decision to quit my postdoc without another job lined up, or really anything lined up per se. I had gotten increasingly obsessed with the potential of software to improve the way scientific research was both conducted and delivered, to feed downstream engineering and policymaking. However, I didn't feel like I was good enough at constructing and deploying software. I felt like I didn't have enough time outside my postdoc work to level up my skills, and I found myself way more interested in process specification and automation rather than actually situating my body and mind to execute the various processes needed for my research, like spinning, etching, and developing wafers in the clean room, ensuring the field emitters on electron and ion microscopes were in appropriate states for high-resolution patterning and metrology, etc. My mind was engaged at the level of programmatic specification and analysis, but I had less and less interest in moving my hands around and in developing precision muscle memories. I had savings, in part because I lived frugally and HP paid well, but also as a STEM grad student, my tuition was covered, I had in-state tuition at Berkeley, and really more broadly, I've benefited immensely from privilege. I'm thankful to be aware of this, and I'm thankful to people who haven't continued to help me call out and help remedy things that essentially limit our collective quality of life. But back to me quitting. I just know I wanted to level up with software skills. Notably, I did not restrict myself to sciencey stuff. I had a vague idea, I guess, from sniffing the ambient glue in Silicon Valley. It was 2012. And I was living in Mountain View at the time, that I would learn how to write and deploy software as a service, SaaS, on the web. Without going into much detail, I developed a platform for facilitating pickup sports games, like Ultimate Basketball, with a friend. And I co-founded a company with a similar goal and worked on that for a bit, but I never earned any stable money. I felt confident and proficient at web development and adjacent software-related activities, but I was reconsidering my decision to not moonlight. Anyway, I chanced upon a job post on Hacker News for a web developer position at Berkeley Lab. I was living in Berkeley at the time, for something called the Materials Project. This was a perfect fit for me at the time, and I think for the project. I had the skills they needed, and because of my education and research background, I could and did go above and beyond what perhaps a median web developer might do to maintain and improve. And I quote from their site, open web-based access to computed information on known and predicted materials, as well as powerful analysis tools to inspire and design novel materials. And as I got even better at software and systems engineering, I resisted the allure of jobs paying 3x my salary or more across the bay because I just loved my work and the project mission and my colleagues, and not to mention the glorious view.
Well, that resonates with me. I also went to Berkeley, and I loved it. And Berkeley's kind of one of the things I loved the view as well. But also I found, I wasn't at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, I was at the university, but I found Berkeley to be, of all the various academic environments that I've been in, I found Berkeley to be the most fundamentally open place where anything could be discussed. And I really love that because I think it led to a huge amount of intellectual activity and stimulation. So I'm not surprised to hear you say that your time in Berkeley was good. So already we've got you've taken some perhaps unusual steps in your career, and then in 2019 you moved to New York, and that in eventually led to you starting Polyneme, which is your own data and software consulting firm. And I mean, for most people, that would seem like a pretty bold step, but it sounds like you like bold steps. But anyway, tell us about the reasons for the latest evolution of your career, and also I'm really interested to hear what you're doing at Polyneme.
Right. Well, one factor at play was this place called the Recurse Center. They run a 12-week retreat for programmers in New York City, and I had wanted to do that for years. I got a tentative okay from my boss at the lab to do a half batch, 6 weeks, hopefully with partial support through continuing education budget for lab employees, but with unpaid leave as a backstop. Another nudge was from my wife, who is from New York City, had family and friends there, and was keen to move back. Finally, I had been thinking a lot about how to use my skills to accelerate scientific R&D more broadly, beyond one project, one organization, in one community of practice, in a sustainable and flexible way. However, I wasn't determined to quit the lab just yet. I figured that as a computerist, I could work remotely from New York. But my boss said she really wanted her team on site, which I totally respect. It's, of course, funny that 6 months later, no one was on site for like 2 years. but I've been happy with my transition. I found and continue to find that I really enjoy learning and getting better at the business aspects of delivering results as an independent legal entity. As for what kinds of work I'm doing, as you mentioned, I've been focused on data collaboration and sharing. Some of this work has been about interacting with data, helping scientists build human and machine interfaces for search, discovery, validation, and process orchestration in general. One example I can talk about publicly is the US National Microbiome Data Collaborative. The mission of the project is, and I quote, to support a fair microbiome data sharing network through infrastructure, data standards, and community building that addresses pressing challenges in environmental science. I've enjoyed working with the NMDC team a lot. Apart from data interaction, I've also been increasingly involved with data representation, not at the level of syntax, although that too, but more at the level of semantics, so really knowledge representation. Some public work I'm doing here is for NASA to help extend the Unified Astronomy Thesaurus to improve discoverability of heliophysics literature in its astrophysics data system. I think that care and representation, specifically being machine-centric about it, is key to making humane interaction with large volumes and varieties of data practical.
Okay, that's really neat. So just... obviously you can't disclose the specific work, but so you mentioned a couple of large organizations that you're working with. Are you also working with individual labs or communities as well?
I am working with some individual labs and communities. Also, some like small industrial labs. Also, I'm working more broadly with community openly, not getting paid for that, but really excited about it. I think we might touch on that, hopefully, about my work with FairPoints.
FairPoints, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Great. And so I guess it's this seems like a good point to introduce something else you're doing, which is your podcast, Machine Centric Science, which, of course, as a fellow podcaster, that's of great interest to me. So tell me what was behind the decision to start the podcast. You know, what are some of the main themes you've been exploring, and what kind of guests have been appearing?
Sure. I decided to start the podcast because I have found certain podcasts helpful to me in understanding and putting into practice ideas. Most recently about pricing and positioning my services. There's something about listening to someone talk and not having to look at anything, like I can walk my dog, that worked for me. I tried to find something similar about putting the FAIR principles into practice, something I could recommend to the kinds of scientists I seek to serve, but I didn't find anything. This was, of course, before I found your podcast, Rory. the main theme has been to hammer the idea that implementing the FAIR principles is about being machine-centric. It's about transitioning your research workflow to revolve around, to cater to machine interpretation. So rather than you being, say, the sun in your lab solar system with all digital assets orbiting around you and depending on your gravitational pull to remain a functioning component of this research system of yours, I'll let the computer help you. Mm-hmm. Let networks of computers help you and your collaborators. You can still produce narratives, manuscripts, presentations, but these revolve around machine actionable knowledge representation. That's what I've been trying to explore. As for guests, I've been most interested in technical practitioners, people I can talk shop with and elicit lessons learned to help listeners grok the FAIR principles and pick up tactics for realizing them in the systems they build.
Okay, that's really interesting. And so, you know, what one of the things that I really enjoy about hosting a podcast is I keep learning new stuff, and also I sometimes get into unexpected things, which is great because it's not always good to predict things. So, you know, what are some of the things you've learned so far, and have there been any interesting and unexpected developments?
Sure, I've learned a lot about FAIR actually. By dedicating one episode to each of the 15 principles, short episodes, but still, I found myself going beyond beyond the epidermis, through the dermis, and to the hypodermis. You know, the subcutaneous concerns of each principle. I also did not expect my response to having guests cancel or retract their interviews due to competitive concerns. My response specifically has been to record and publish little songs where I adapt some existing songs' lyrics to be about FAIR somehow. They're not very good, but I've done three so far anyway, and I guess I'm not great at containing my weirdness.
Oh, well, I can look for those on Top of the Pops, I'm sure, the top of the whatever it is these days on YouTube or Spotify. But actually, just to drill down a bit, I think your point about getting under the skin, how's that for a pun? Under the skin of the FAIR principles is an interesting one, because I think I feel the same way. When you can approach FAIR at different levels, and you at a high level, and it makes sense, and it actually makes sense at different levels as well. But as you drill down, a couple of things happen, I think. So one is, as you say, you discover things which were you didn't really think of before. I also think there's a let me go out on a limb here and say, be a bit critical. I think there's also a danger of some of the of reification of FAIR. So I think the high level principles have their role, and when people try to become too prescriptive about, in order to realize the A or the I in FAIR, you need to do the following 67 things. I'm thinking to myself, well, first of all, nobody's going to do that, and secondly, is that really what the exercise or the direction of travel should be about? And I don't think so. But in any event, the kind of exercise that you're forcing of getting under the skin, it definitely stimulates thought and insights. I would certainly agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so we touched, you mentioned briefly, you're also one of the founders of FairPoints, which is an event series highlighting pragmatic measures developed by the community towards the implementation of fair data principles. And your partners in crime at FairPoints include Sarah El-Ghabali and Chris Erdman. As it happens, both of them appeared not that recently, but earlier in the year on this podcast. So some listeners might have, through that or otherwise, might have some familiarity with FairPoint. But for those who don't, tell us about it, and also tell us what's, you know, what's new at FairPoints, and what are some things that are coming.
Sure. Well, the most exciting news for me personally is that Sarah, Chris, and I will be meeting together in person for the first time at the conference on Fair Digital Objects in Leiden at the end of October. We submitted an abstract on publishing fair points, that is, training material developed during our events as fair digital objects, which I'll be presenting. Also, we have an event on Friday, September 30th, for which Sarah came up with a great idea for fairifying participant activity. I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent. Yeah, that was actually one I, just on that point, because that reminds me, I was recently at a really interesting event, which I actually spoke about a couple of weeks ago on a special edition of the podcast, which was the Open Science Festival, the Netherlands National Open Science Festival in Amsterdam. And one of the things that really struck me about that event was how participative it was structured in a very participative way, and there were a bunch of kind of workshops during the day which were very participative. But that's not unexpected. But what I thought was very innovative was the fact that the plenary sessions, in which there were 300-400 people in this huge auditorium, and they were being run by no less than the rector of the university and the head of the library as kind of a dual tag team. And they actually managed to involve the members of the audience in serious discussions, some of which were intentionally uncomfortable to themselves. So they were not easy issues to be discussing. And they did it, they pulled it off. They did it in a very fair way, so to speak. So I thought that was, it was very risky, but it worked. And to their credit, so that was great. So I'll be really interested to see how your event on the 30th of September goes. And I think it's a great direction. And for sure, at least in that case, I think it brought out certain points of discussion which would not have come out unless they adopted that organizational principle. So, yeah. Yeah, well, thanks, Noph. I'm a big fan of FairPoints, so thanks for that. And it's great to hear that you'll be also in Leiden in October. So let's change tack a bit and come away from FairPoints and get back to some of the work that you're doing. I know, in addition to your podcast, you also write, and one of the things I've noticed in your recent writing, you've been writing a lot about identifiers, which is obviously a topic of great and growing current interest. So conversations about identifiers seem to be popping up everywhere. It is hard for me, at least, to keep up with the almost tsunami of developments. So among all this huge activity that's going on, what do you think are the key issues that we should be focusing on as identifiers enter the mainstream of research, data practice, and management?
Sure. So I'm just pulling up something here that came to mind. I'm going to appeal to authority here in the form of the World Wide Web Consortium's recommendation called Architecture of the World Wide Web, Volume 1. It discusses three specific areas of concern. Two I've already touched on, interaction and representation, that is, data formats. The first area, though, is identification. Key issues that it identifies that I do think we need to focus on are, one, using global identifiers. This is because global naming leads to global network effects. Two, using URIs. This allows us to benefit from and increase the value of the web. Then also having URIs identify a single resource. This can be tricky with landing pages versus served articles and revisions to either, but it's an issue. Another thing is trying to avoid URI aliases where possible. So multiple names for the same thing, just because aliasing reduces network effects, the Metcalfe effect. Another thing is consistent URI usage. That is character by character fidelity of references. Again, network effects. Another thing is reusing URI schemes rather than creating new ones. Specifically to this, I think HTTP URIs are usually the way to go. And then finally, one thing that I've been concerned about is URI opacity and that issue. I don't think in most cases we should attempt to infer properties of referenced resources from their identifiers, nor should we attempt to encode them there. That's the job of metadata. Yeah.
Those are very specific. I think, it'd be interesting to see if, that's great. Thank you. That's actually a great contribution. I'd be interested to see if any of our listeners, comment on those things, because that's very, very useful for me, and I'm sure for others too. So other than identifiers, in your current thinking, what are some of the other key issues in the area of FAIR and data that are forefront of your mind these days?
Sure. One thing that's, I guess, related to identifiers is the archival resource key scheme for identifiers. So I've been working with John Kunz on that, and I've been involved with the technical and outreach working groups there. The big thing there is about decoupling allocation or minting of identifiers and resolution. So the key here is that I really think that being able to allocate and mint identifiers should be dirt cheap and easy. And then it's kind of a separate issue from do we need to serve them? Do we need to pay a service provider to actually serve our metadata? But actually just giving things IDs, I think that's a great idea of the ARC scheme that I like, and can be replicated elsewhere. Another thing I've been thinking about, I read this great manuscript called Sharing Begins at Home. It's about continuous and ubiquitous fairness out of some folks at University of Southern California. And it's essentially don't wait until the end of your research life cycle to make it fair. You can have those benefits, while you're doing your research, while you're, using your electronic lab notebook, while you have your system, all this stuff. It can be always fair. You can always be publishing, just not openly, and everything, all these resources can be publication quality, but you're not openly publishing them. And that can make sort of fulfilling data management plans and FAIR mandates a lot easier, because it's just sort of already like that and you're getting those benefits in your lab. I guess something related to that I've been interested in lately is the idea of data portability and open infrastructure. I'm not sure I agree with all of them, but I do like, I've encountered the principles of open scholarly infrastructure, I think started by some people at Crossref, and a lot of people have signed on to it. Among other things, it posits, the data, should be as open and retrievable as possible. And these organizations that steward the services, we should be able to migrate from them if possible. We shouldn't be locked into them, just for the longevity and persistence of the data. And I guess the final thing that's been on my mind recently is FAIR implementation and paths to formalizing that. There's some great work by Eric Schultz and Barbara Magagna and others, the GoFAIR Foundation for the FAIR implementation profile ontology, and this idea of FAIR enabling resources. And so I've been exploring that a little bit, and how to kind of, holistically decompose the different things that have to be in play so that people can tackle them one by one and find themselves with FAIR infrastructure rather than it being a huge hairball. So I think that's also an issue that's been on my mind.
Well, that's an interesting list. Interesting. So can I ask one final question about the first thing you mentioned was the identifiers and decoupling the minting from the resolution. So right. how would that impact existing providers like ORCID and DataCite and Crossref and those kind of organizations? Does that imply a kind of a fundamental reorganization of the way the universe is structured or not?
Well, There are a couple of systems that are already kind of decoupled in nature because they have these prefixes that are assigned. So the handle system, which includes DOIs, which are just handles that start with 10, you know, they are given prefixes. And right now the idea is that there are a few organizations that can dole those out. You know, theoretically, any small lab can be assigned a full prefix, just like they can be assigned a full ARC name assigning authority number, and then they can mint whatever they want in there, and there's no namespace collisions. And then it's a matter of actually dispatching to a provider. In the case of the handle system, you know, everyone's pretty much agreed to respect other people's DOI. So for example, I can mint a handle, and it's not technically a DOI, but if I go to doi.org/myhandle, it'll resolve because that's sort of the agreement that handle providers have made. You can do a similar thing with ARCs by switching mapping authority providers. It's a little hard when the URI contains an actual authority component that's not delegated, like ORCID.org. Like only, you know, people who have control of ORCID.org can do that. So that's a little trickier. It could be done in principle by partitioning the space. It's just about people having authority and being able to delegate it. So as long as that's sort of trusted in the community, I mean, that's really how the domain name system works. Like I don't have my domain name, my registrar has it, but they kind of allocate it to me. And so similarly, I could imagine, you know, ORCID allocating a range of numbers to an institution and having them manage it. So I don't think that's a technical issue. It's definitely more of like a social organizational, issue, but that, there is precedent for and prior art for in the domain name system and the internet and for, honestly, for identifiers, for the handle system and for ARCs. So I think it's doable.
Fantastic. Actually, that's great. That's something new to me. I hadn't really thought about that. Great. Well, listen, Donnie, thank you so much for what's been a really stimulating and, conversation where I've certainly, you touched upon a bunch of things which I didn't know about or I understand better now. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's great. It's great talking with you, Roy.
Okay. Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. The Fair Data Podcast is provided by fairdatapodcast.org and produced by Mehroz Ahmed. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at Fair Data Podcast. New episodes are released every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. UK, 5 p.m. Central European Time, and late in Asia Pacific. See you then.